1941. Chapter 2. Luray's Run. Pat Reed believed that escaping from POW camps was the sworn duty of all officers. He believed this with passionate intensity, and he disdained those who did not share his conviction. But he was wrong. In fact, no such obligation was incumbent on those who were captured. Most inmates of Colditz were there because they had already tried to escape from somewhere else, and so, unsurprisingly, many arrived determined to get out again. For some, escape became an obsession and the dominant topic of conversation. But not everyone was equally keen on escaping. Some were prepared to sit out the war in captivity and lead, as one disdainful escaper put it, a vegetable existence. In certain circumstances, officers gave their word of honour, or parole, that they would not attempt to escape. They might borrow tools, for example, to build a stage set, on a solemn promise that these would not be used for escaping. Non-combatant officers, including medics and clergymen, were occasionally permitted to take parole walks, under guard, in the countryside around the castle, on the strict understanding that they would not abuse this privilege by running away. Not once did a prisoner give such a guarantee and then break his word. Escaping was not only difficult, but dangerous. Under the Geneva Convention, a POW caught on the run was liable to a maximum punishment of 1 month in solitary confinement. But not all German officers were as punctilious as Eggers in sticking to the rules. Sentries carried arms and were prepared to use them, and the choice of when to deploy force was frequently left to the discretion and inclination of individual officers or guards. Anyone found outside the camp in civilian clothes, or worse, wearing German uniform, ran the risk of being shot as a spy. If an escapee was handed over to the Wehrmacht military authorities, he was usually sent back to Colditz for a stint in the solitary cells. But if he fell into the clutches of the Gestapo or the SS, his fate was far more uncertain. He might be tortured, sent to a concentration camp, or even shot out of hand. As the Allied bombing of German cities intensified, enraged civilians were increasingly likely to mete out summary punishment to recaptured prisoners. And just as escaping was not a duty, nor was it a right, one class of prisoners never escaped from Colditz and was not encouraged to try. The lower class. Running through the very heart of Colditz ran a wide and almost unbridgeable social divide. This was a camp for captured officers, but it also contained a fluctuating population of orderlies, ordinary soldier prisoners from the other ranks employed by the Germans to perform menial tasks and work as servants for their senior officers, cooking, tidying, cleaning, boot polishing, and other chores. By Christmas 1940, Colditz held 17 British officers and 8 orderlies, a ratio that remained broadly constant throughout the war. Senior officers each had a personal servant, or batman, while more junior officers shared an orderly, usually one to each mess. Some were brought in from other camps and then rotated elsewhere after 6 months. A few remained in Colditz throughout the war. They received the same rations as the officers, including Red Cross supplies, but occupied different quarters. The orderlies were not invited to take part in escape attempts and were not expected to assist them, though some did. Once a week, they were taken for a walk in the countryside outside the castle under guard. None ever tried to escape, and with good reason. A recaptured officer would usually be returned to the castle unharmed, whereas ordinary soldiers were liable to suffer the most draconian punishment. If an orderly was caught, he wouldn't get the same treatment as an officer, said one batman. He'd probably get shot. As private soldiers, the lowest rung on the military ladder, they were required to obey the orders of the Germans as well as their own officers, without question. They ate, slept, and lived entirely separately. Less educated than the officers, the orderlies did not write memoirs after the war, and their experiences have therefore been almost wholly omitted from the broader Colditz story. Today, it seems bizarre and unjust that one prisoner should have to serve another, that one man should be permitted to seek his liberty and another forbidden to do so on the grounds of rank and class. But under the Geneva Convention, every captured officer had a right to be attended by an orderly, as he would if he were free. In the strictly stratified military hierarchy of the time, an officer was more valuable than a private, and therefore more useful to the war effort if he managed to escape and return to Britain. An officer was not permitted to work, but a private soldier was required to. One therefore served the other. At the start, most orderlies were reasonably content to be in Colditz, where the work was not overly onerous and the food better than in other camps. Shining an officer's belt buckle was infinitely preferable to forced labour. "After the copper mines, Colditz was a holiday camp," observed one orderly. Sidney Goldman was batman to the first senior British officer at Colditz, the confusingly named Guy German. Lieutenant Colonel German had been captured during the Norwegian campaign and sent to Colditz for publicly burning copies of a Nazi propaganda newspaper. His servant went with him. Solly Goldman was a Jewish cockney from London's East End, with, as Reed put it, a lightning wit. Eggers called him the ace amongst the orderlies, because while Goldman was impudent and entertaining, he was also obedient. Solly Goldman would be seen regularly in the early morning toting a steaming jug of ersatz coffee across the cobbled courtyard towards the senior officers' quarters. Colonel German was a farmer in civilian life, with a blunt manner and an earthy vocabulary. When the new senior British officer was informed that the British prisoners should look smarter during roll calls, German replied with an expletive translated as, "The Germans can jolly well lump it." He was said to be devoted to his manservant Goldman, but there was never any doubt about their respective positions in the prison pecking order. According to the Colditz myth, all its inmates sought to escape on principle all the time, in a universal spirit of cooperation, while sadistic and stupid German guards tried to stop them. The reality was more complicated. Many prisoners did try to escape, but a lot did not, either because they were not supposed to, like the orderlies, or because they did not want to. With exceptions, most of the German guards were not brutes, and some, like Eggers, were not even Nazis. There was honour on both sides. German military thinking tended towards absolutes. Total war, total victory, and in this case, a prison camp that was totally escape-proof. Under the Geneva Convention, the authorities could take special measures to detain particularly difficult prisoners. Pat Reed listed these as more roll calls, more searches, more sentries, less exercise space, less privacy, less privileges. From the outset, prisoners at Colditz were not just closely guarded, but under round-the-clock surveillance. An escaping prisoner would first have to get out of the inner courtyard, a massive stone box with walls 7 feet thick and 90 feet high, and bars on every window. To leave the way he came in, through the main gate, a prisoner would then have to traverse the German garrison courtyard. In the valley to the west was the village of Colditz, its railway station tantalisingly visible. To the east lay the park, with inviting woods beyond. But to get out, the escaper would have to navigate terraces swathed in barbed wire or clamber down the sheer cliffs on three sides of the fortress. Once beyond the castle perimeter, the escapee faced even greater obstacles. Colditz was a garrison town, and its 6,000 civilian inhabitants were already alert for fugitive prisoners. As soon as an escape was discovered, the castle commandant sent out an emergency alert with the code word Mousetrap to railway stations and police posts for a radius of 25 miles. Within a few hours, every railway worker, cafe keeper, forester and policeman would be on the lookout. Even the Hitler Youth, the Nazi Party youth organisation, was mobilised to hunt down the fugitives. Search parties on foot and mounted on bicycles scoured the woods and fields, and sentries manned every crossroads. If the escaper managed to reach a frontier, he still had to get through wartime border controls, tighter than at any previous time in history. Getting out of Germany was far harder than getting out of Colditz. It is difficult to escape when starving. An empty stomach fills the mind, sometimes to the point of fixation, with thoughts of where the next meal is coming from. The prisoners of Colditz were not yet famished, but the calorific content of the slop doled out by the prison kitchen was far below what was needed to keep them healthy and active. The first major boost to prisoner morale came not with a successful escape, but in the form of 15 rectangular cardboard boxes weighing 10 pounds each. A consignment of food parcels arrived in Colditz on Boxing Day 1940, the initial trickle of a great wave of supplies that would supplement the meagre prison fare and sustain the prisoners in body and mind for most of the rest of the war. After the deprivation of the previous months, the parcels came as manna from heaven, or, more precisely, from the International Red Cross charity based in Switzerland. The contents included tea, cocoa, tinned meat, butter, pickled eggs, syrup, and cigarettes. For months, cut off from the outside world, the prisoners had survived on the sparse rations from the German kitchens. Here was tangible, edible evidence they had not been forgotten. In prison camps across Germany, the arrival of these first Red Cross parcels was a moment of excitement prisoners savoured forever. As treasure after treasure was revealed, drooled over, fondled and sampled. Deliveries were at first unpredictable, and stocks had to be teased out over months. But by the spring of 1941, the prisoners were receiving regular deliveries, sometimes as much as one parcel a week. There were English cigarettes in place of the lung-ravaging German or Polish varieties. "I lit one up and took a big drag," recalled one smoker. "I almost lost my sense in sheer delight." In time, the Red Cross would also supply limited medicines and essential clothing. The prisoners also started to receive letters and personal packages from friends and family back home. These were carefully searched for contraband before being distributed to each addressee at the parcels office. They were permitted to write back, up to 4 postcards and 2 letters a month, with as little as 6 weeks between dispatch and delivery. This was a barbaric war, but the provision of food, letters, books, sporting equipment, medicine and clothing to POWs on both sides was a beacon of civilised behaviour amid the carnage, insufficiently celebrated and of inestimable value. Many more prisoners in Germany would have died without the Red Cross parcels, and the impact was immediate. Gone were the hangdog stances of the ragged and starving. Faces were fuller. The arrival of limited supplies from outside also presented opportunities for stockpiling, hoarding and trading, in which one man's consignment of condensed milk might be swapped for another's excess stock of tea. Cigarettes became a currency to be bartered with guards for real money, essential to any escape attempt through Germany. Prison guards faced serious punishment if they were caught trading or accepting bribes, but even the most conscientious sentry might be rendered cooperative by a pound of chocolate and 100 cigarettes. Spring saw a steady influx of new arrivals. More British officers and orderlies, including Colonel German and his batman, Solly Goldman, several dozen Poles, two Yugoslav airmen who had volunteered for the RAF before being shot down over France, a handful of Belgians, and more than 200 Frenchmen. Some had tried to escape from other camps, but 20 of the French officers had no idea why they had been moved to Colditz and therefore called themselves les Innocents, the Innocents. Two of the Belgians were labelled Deutschfeindlich because they had cooked and eaten a cat in their previous camp, a meal they described as delicious, just like rabbit. The French contingent included some 60 Jewish officers. "It was a Europe in miniature," said one inmate, and like Europe, the prison population was nominally united, but with distinct internal divisions and racial tensions. The French were aggrieved that the Poles got on better with the British. The Poles felt the French had failed to put up sufficient resistance to Nazi invasion. The Belgians resented being thought of as more or less French. The British simultaneously admired and distrusted the French, knowing that many remained loyal to the puppet Vichy regime in unoccupied France. One prisoner saw the Anglo-French tension as the inevitable clashing impact of French curiosity on British sluggish phlegm. Everyone liked the Yugoslavs. There were strong individual friendships across nationalities, and many paired off for language lessons, but there was inevitably a tendency to fall back on stereotypes. Then, as now, the different European nationalities lived and worked in harmony, except when they didn't. The new British arrivals included three chaplains, among them a Methodist minister, Joseph Ellison Platt, who had been captured near Dunkirk. Padre Jock Platt would keep a daily diary throughout his time in Colditz, a detailed account of everyday life in the prison, but also an extended sermon. For Platt was a Christian of iron conventionality who stared sternly at the world through thick horn-rimmed spectacles and found moral instruction wherever he looked. He possessed a radiant certainty and hope which nothing could destroy, according to the Directory of Primitive Methodist Ministers. This was a polite Christian way of saying he had complete faith in his own rectitude and never hesitated to correct anyone who disagreed with him. He should not have been in Colditz. In his previous camp, a mysterious metal instrument presumed to be for escape purposes had been found in his locker, and he was packed off to Colditz. It was, in fact, a wire for propping up the lid of his ancient suitcase. The pastor had no intention of escaping. He had a captive flock, and he planned to ensure that whatever trials lay ahead, they did not stray from the path of righteousness. In the public school hierarchy emerging at Colditz, Colonel German was head boy, Reed, the captain of the first 11, and Platt, the school chaplain. The growing French contingent included some irrepressible personalities, men considered too defiant to be held in a normal camp, of whom the most indomitable, as well as the most enigmatic, was Alain Leray, a lieutenant in the Chasseurs Alpins, the elite French mountain infantry force. Leray had been wounded and captured during the Battle of France, and then held at a camp on the Oder estuary. An experienced mountaineer with honed survival skills, he had escaped into the teeth of the Baltic winter and headed for France, hiding in a snow grave during the day and hopping on freight trains at night. He was just 60 miles short of the French border when he was caught and sent to Colditz. From the moment of Luray's arrival, Pat Reed noticed something distinctive about this handsome, black-haired, debonair young man, an inner intensity that set him apart from the other Frenchmen. Leray teamed up with an English officer to improve his English and willingly recounted his adventures, yet he seldom took part in the talk of escape, despite an undisguised determination to do so. "Some would-be escapers were loners," wrote Reed, who found this secretive and solitary Frenchman both intriguing and unsettling. Reed was the ultimate team player, a backslapping enthusiast who chivied others to take part in whatever scheme he was hatching. Luray was the opposite. As lithe and agile as a cat, he possessed a feline detachment and self-containment. Luray had a plan, and he had no intention of telling anyone, least of all the garrulous Pat Reed, what it was. With the exterior of Colditz so heavily guarded, the most logical way to try to get out undetected was underground. Digging a tunnel would take patience, planning, and manpower, all of which were available in abundance. By the spring of 1941, the British, the Poles, and the French were each working on independent tunnels in different parts of the camp, without informing each other. In the ground beneath Colditz, a secret and undeclared contest was underway. A team of French tunnellers, including Luray, broke into the clock tower in the northwest corner of the courtyard. By early February, they had dug a shaft 10 feet into the cellar, from which they began burrowing a horizontal tunnel to the outside, digging quietly at night, in shifts, using pieces of metal bed frame, and spreading the spoil in the attics. The Poles, meanwhile, were secretly working on a tunnel at the other side of the courtyard, aiming to connect with the castle's sewage system. A similar thought occurred to Pat Reed. "I was attracted by the drains," he wrote. In the ground floor canteen, where the prisoners lined up to buy the few items it contained, lay a large manhole cover. One afternoon, while the German sergeant on duty was distracted, Reed and a fellow officer levered off the lid and carried out a swift reconnaissance. In one direction, the drain led back to the courtyard, connecting with another manhole, but to the east, it curved towards the outer wall for some 18 feet, where it was blocked by a stone wall. Beyond that lay a triangle of lawn, with a balustrade on one side and a 30-foot drop to the roadway leading out to the park. Following the Polish example, the British had already carved a key that opened the old-fashioned lever lock on the door at the foot of the staircase leading from their quarters into the courtyard. If they could get into the canteen undetected, surmised Reed, they might be able to dig through the stone wall at the end of the drain, construct a horizontal tunnel under the little lawn, and then push a vertical shaft upwards through the grass. The escapers could then climb down the parapet with bedsheets, creep past the German quarters, climb over the 12-foot park wall, and head for the woods. If the opening of the tunnel was concealed by a detachable wooden trapdoor with a turf covering, the exit might be undetected after the first escape and then used again. If a team of tunnellers could slip in at night and lock the canteen door behind them, they might dig undisturbed until daybreak. The devil makes work for idle hands, and Padre Platt decided that Reed's tunnel was a wholesome activity deserving of his blessing. It will occupy about 2 or 3 months, working 2 or 3 hours a night after lights out. While the canteen guard was distracted, his key was borrowed from the table drawer, pressed into a bar of soap, and then returned. It took just a few days to make a duplicate from part of an iron bedstead. Lookouts, or stooges, were watching from the upper floors soon after midnight when 4 men emerged from the British staircase, crossed the 10 yards of dark courtyard without being spotted, and entered the canteen. It took a week of nocturnal quarrying to break through the 4-foot wall at the end of the drain. Beyond it, the ground consisted of sticky yellow clay. Then came near calamity, evidence of how easily one escape attempt could scupper another. In mid-March, 2 Poles broke into the canteen, unaware of the British tunnel being built under their feet, and set about sawing through the bars of the window overlooking the patch of grass. The noise attracted a sentry, and they were caught. A large new floodlight was erected facing directly onto the lawn. Henceforth, this dark corner of the castle was lit up every night like a theatre stage. Tunnelling by hand is a time-consuming and exhausting business, requiring huge reserves of perseverance, a quality that, like so many others, was unevenly distributed among the prisoners. Tunnelling did not suit me, admitted Alain Leray, the maverick Frenchman. I was getting too impatient. What I wanted was something quick that I could execute alone. The courtyard, where prisoners milled around during the day, was far too cramped for any serious exercise. The Geneva Convention, however, stated that prisoners shall have facilities for engaging in physical exercise and obtaining the benefit of being out of doors. And so the Germans erected two enclosures in the park, surrounded by 6-foot wire fencing, a large one for running and walking, and a smaller cage for games of football or rugby. 2 or 3 times a week saw the park walk, when prisoners who wanted exercise, and not all did, assembled in the courtyard and were carefully counted before being marched past the commandantur, down a zigzagging path, across the stream and into the park enclosures. The park walk was a formal affair with a touch of menace, but march is an orderly word for an event that was frequently chaotic and became more so as the prison population expanded. The prisoners were counted inside the courtyard, outside it, on arrival in and leaving the park, a laborious rigmarole which the more unruly prisoners did their best to disrupt at every stage. The prisoners never wore the same clothing, failed to form up in neat ranks, and refused to walk in straight lines. Crocodiling around corners, concertinaing on the straight bits, jostling in the gateway, pointing, calling back, calling forward, dropping things. The whole process offended Eggers's sense of order and gave Alain Leray his chance. At the bottom of the path leading into the park stood a dilapidated building known as the Terrace House, used to store building materials. Shortly before Easter, on the park walk, Leray noticed that the door had been left ajar. Confiding in only 2 fellow officers, he assembled his escape kit. A set of civilian clothes, a map of the German railway system, and a few Reichsmarks, obtained by bartering cigarettes with a guard. On Good Friday, Leray put on a greatcoat over a set of homemade civilian clothes and joined the crowd heading down to the park to watch a football match. On the way back, as they turned the corner beside the Terrace House, Leray's coat was whipped off and put on by the man standing behind him, as he scrambled up the bank and in through the door. He lay panting, listening for sounds of pursuit, but all was silent. No shouts, no chase, no dogs. Back up at the castle, 2 accomplices staged a fight. In the confusion, the Germans muddled the recount, and Leray's absence passed unnoticed. As night fell, he ran down the path and headed for the outer wall. In the open, he felt dangerously exposed. The whole park was like a great eye watching me. Leray scrambled over the wall and into the trees. After walking 5 miles, he reached the town of Rochlitz, where he boarded a train for nearby Penig, and then spent his remaining cash on a train to Zwickau, 50 miles to the south. There, he hid in the guard's van of the next train leaving the station. 24 hours after climbing out of Colditz, he was in Nuremberg, where the Nazi party had staged huge rallies celebrating Hitler's rise to power. Leray was penniless, freezing, famished, and in the very heart of the Reich. That night, he waited in an alleyway. When a lone man approached, Leray jumped out of the shadows, knocked him down with 2 swift punches, stripped off his coat, stole his wallet, and vanished back into the darkness. It was, he conceded, a brutal act of robbery with violence against a civilian, which he justified as self-defense under conditions of warfare. The mugging also upped the stakes. He would now face the death penalty if caught. The stolen money bought him a train ticket to Stuttgart, and then another southwards towards the Swiss border. As a mountaineer, Luray had intended to climb into Switzerland across the Eastern Alps. But after 5 days on the run, his strength was ebbing. Instead, he made for Singen, where the border was long and flat. Setting out from the station towards the frontier through thick woodland, he was spotted by a German border patrol. After a frantic chase, the fugitive evaded capture by shinning up a tree. Aware that the border guards would now be on high alert, he doubled back to the railway station at Gottmadingen, the last stop in Germany before the train crossed into Switzerland. Buying another train ticket was out of the question. Luray hid in the undergrowth at the end of the platform. The 11:30 from Singen pulled in, and the train came to a halt just 10 feet from where he was concealed. The guard looked up and down the deserted platform, blew his whistle, and turned his back. At that instant, Luray clambered over the tracks in front of the locomotive, climbed onto the front, curled up between the headlights, and clung on. The driver opened the throttle, and the train roared through the fresh air of the spring night, wrote Luray, who sat upright on the coupling between the bumpers, his feet dangling inches above the rushing rails. Fear and exhaustion forgotten, the Frenchman felt a wild surge of hope and pride as the train picked up speed. We passed the red lights of the enemy guard post, on under the bridge, and then into Switzerland. Luray had spent just 46 days in Colditz. Luray's home run prompted a surge of loud rejoicing among the prisoners, and a corresponding wave of recrimination and investigation by the German authorities. Here was proof that escape, hitherto only a theoretical possibility, was a real and achievable goal. The Germans had built an escape-proof prison, and a Frenchman had climbed out of it within 7 weeks of arriving. The commandant gave his officers a ferocious dressing down. "We've all been made fools of by one prisoner." Berlin wanted answers, and, like all tyrannies, someone to pin the blame on. Who was responsible? Had he been punished? Sniffer dogs were brought in to no effect. Eggers concluded, wrongly, that the French alpinist must have clambered over the roofs and down a 90-foot lightning conductor. Extra barbed wire was unfurled around the chimneys, a 24-hour guard posted in the inner courtyard, and more powerful searchlights installed. Safe in Switzerland, Luray described his escape to the French consul, who told the British, who sent word to London. The prisoners of war directorate inside the War Department began to take a closer interest in high-security camp Offlag 4C. Luray's escape had been a solo effort, of which his senior officers and all but two fellow inmates had been entirely unaware. Not only were individuals planning their own escapes, but the different nationalities were launching plans that overlapped, conflicted, and might prove mutually counterproductive. The different tunnel plans were, almost literally, undermining one another. One night, when the British were working on their tunnel, the Germans called a snap nighttime roll call, one of the new security measures brought in by the commandant, and discovered four men were missing. By the morning appel, the canteen diggers had reappeared, to the baffled fury of the Germans, who launched an intensive search of the castle and uncovered the French tunnel under construction in the base of the clock tower. The Polish attempt to escape through the canteen had already imperiled the British tunnel, which, by the end of March, was approaching a point near the middle of the lawn. Then came a fresh setback. Two more officers, French this time, were caught trying to get out of the canteen window. Eggers was now on the prowl. We suspected that canteen. The Germans levered off the manhole cover, but found nothing suspicious, as the tunnellers had constructed a false wall at the near end from rubble mortared with mud that looked exactly like the real thing. Eggers had the manhole cemented down with new clasps, which the prisoners loosened before they set, put a new lock on the canteen door, and, worst of all, posted a 24-hour sentry on the lawn outside the window, precisely where the tunnel exit was supposed to emerge. Tunnelling was suspended. Overlapping escape attempts and competing tunnels clearly showed the need for at least a minimal degree of coordination and collaboration. An international escape committee was established with a set of cardinal principles. Individuals would obtain permission from their senior officer before attempting to escape, and the senior officers of each nationality would then inform each other. Like many international liaison initiatives, this was a fine idea in principle, but problematic in practice. Secrecy was the central pillar of every escape. Plans had to be kept from the Germans, obviously, but also from competitors who could try to steal an idea, and from possible spies or stool pigeons who might be lurking among the prison population. "Most escapers were unwilling to share their idea until sometimes at the very last moment," wrote Reed. The French psychology rebelled against such conformity anyway. "We were far too individualistic to accept that kind of system," recalled one French officer. "We did it among ourselves, and we didn't like telling anyone anything." Whenever a new plan was floated, the Poles, having been in the castle longer than any other group, tended to insist that they had thought of it first. But over time, the bonds of trust and familiarity strengthened between and within the different national groups, bringing a greater willingness to aid the escape plans of others, so long as that did not impede their own. Just like the Allies in the wider war, prisoners were united but rivals, competing with each other while locked in battle with a common enemy. In the intimate confines of Colditz, that enemy was becoming ever more familiar. On a battlefield, the foe is anonymous. In a prison, he has a face, a name, and a personality. At the top of the German chain of command stood the commandant himself, Oberstleutnant, Lieutenant Colonel Max Schmidt, an army veteran who stuck to the rules and seldom intruded into the prisoners' lives. Schmidt left the daily running of the castle to his underlings, living a domestic existence with his wife in a private apartment inside the Kommandantur, and emerging only to make formal pronouncements or issue punishments. Eggers described him as an imposing figure with cold grey eyes and an austere way of executing his authority, uncomfortable but effective. Eggers's immediate boss, the senior camp officer, was Hauptmann Captain Paul Priem, another former schoolmaster but of a very different sort. Priem was a cheerful drunk, regarded by the prisoners as the only German with a sense of humour, albeit of the thumpingly unsubtle variety. Eggers considered his immediate superior to be altogether too easygoing, but liked him nonetheless, a charming companion, and a lively character, fond of battle, fond of life, fond of the bottle. Like many alcoholics, Priem could switch in an instant from joviality to apoplectic fury. Priem was a belligerent supporter of Hitler, whereas Eggers and others in the German officers' mess had little time for fascism, including Commandant Schmidt, who discouraged political discussion and never gave the Nazi salute. These differences of political opinion were reflected in contrasting attitudes towards the prisoners. Hardliners maintained that escape attempts should be met with force, lethal if necessary. Others sought to cultivate good relations with the inmates on the grounds that they were fellow soldiers. The ideological cleavage within the German garrison, between the Nazis and the non-fascists, the enforcers and those inclined to leniency, would continue throughout the life of the camp. As Eggers noted, "We were not a harmonious team." The German non-commissioned officers, promoted through the enlisted ranks, acted as the main contacts between prisoners and guards. They were awarded nicknames which became, over time, permanent and well known to their owners. The two sergeant majors were Franz Josef Rutenberger and Mussolini Gephard, who, like Il Duce, was both fat and fascist. Unteroffizier Senior Corporal Martin Schädlich, an indefatigable sleuth, was known as La Fouine, the weasel, to the French, and dubbed Dixon Hawk by the British, a reference to the fictional detective popular at the time. The canny Schädlich's diaries offer another, often overlooked angle on Colditz, the view from the German NCO's mess. Nicknames were a mark of familiarity that could be cruel, affectionate, mocking, descriptive, or entirely arbitrary. Allocating the jailers monikers diminished their power, rendering them human and frequently ridiculous. The nicknames for Colditz guards, collectively referred to as the ferrets, included Big Bum, Ropey, Dopey, Pie Face, Tiger, Cheese, Snuffler, Hiawatha, Eggs, Auntie, and Bastard. Eggers was by far the most formidable of the German officers. Long before the prisoners began testing possible avenues out of the castle, he was exploring ways to keep them in, an approach that was systematic, scientific, and extremely effective. The British feared and distrusted him, particularly Pat Reed, who considered him foxy, competent, and a bit too smooth. Eggers liked to wander into the British barracks of an evening to speak English and reminisce about his time in Cheltenham. But behind his smile, he was sniffing for clues. The animosity towards Eggers came with a nagging respect. "It was a thorn in our side because he was very good at his job," said Kenneth Lockwood, one of the original Laufen Six. He thought he understood how the British mentality worked and was rather slimy in that regard. The French nicknamed him Tartuffe, after the character in Molière's play, the most famous hypocrite in French literature. Eggers believed the name derived from his habit of suppressing all my hostile or unpleasant reactions beneath a somewhat strained and wavering grin. He took the nickname as a compliment. For in addition to his intelligence and discipline, Eggers possessed an even temper, forged by years of being baited by schoolboys. Soon after the British arrived, he made an observation to the SBO, Guy German, that sounded like a challenge. "I will never allow you gentlemen the honour of getting me rattled." That resolution was assaulted on a daily basis over the next 4 years, and the German officer was ragged mercilessly. If escaping was the main arena of rivalry inside the camp, then trying to egg Eggers into losing his composure was a close second. As the late spring weather grew warmer, Eggers could sense anticipation heating up in the camp, a restlessness presaging more escapes. Yet Eggers felt a justified measure of pride. So far, just one prisoner had got away, and several attempts had been foiled. Security was improving all the time. The inmates included seasoned escape artists, with more arriving from other camps every week, but Eggers was confident. The experts had to lay on absolute masterpieces to beat us.